Hello, everyone. The date is April 24th. It's a Wednesday night, at least on this side of the world. And that means it is time for another edition of Mass Office Hours. I believe we are in week 33 of Mass Office Hours. Quite a run that we're on here. Every week, like clockwork, Wednesday, 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Thanks so much for joining us. If you're live in the YouTube chat today, I am with the good Dr. Eric Helms, joining from the other side of the world, where it happens to be Thursday. Helms, you were recently in Australia. How was that?
It was great. Yeah, we had the Sports Nutrition Association conference in Gold Coast, and it happened to be the 2 days before my 41st birthday.
Wow.
So it was a really good trip. For those who don't know, Sports Nutrition Association is a really good group of folks who are trying to bridge that middle ground between personal training and sports dietetics, with the reality being that personal trainers are often simply not equipped with the knowledge or the education to provide true sports nutrition guidance. And there's just not that many dietitians out there. And the schooling you need to become a sports dietitian, this is more of a pitch to people who are interested in working with athletes. I've met a few people who work in the sports field who ended up getting their RD, and they go, did I really need a year of doing feeding tubes and working with people with diabetes to do that? Maybe not. And I would have really preferred a much more direct path. So it's a really cool pathway that actually gives you insurance that protects sports nutrition practice. We've got a lot of great people involved, like Reed Real, who is the guy who did the first research on like water loading. Dr. Reed Real, he was part of Australia Institute of Sport, and now he runs the UFC sports science in Shanghai. Jordy Sullivan, who does also great work as a fight nutritionist, as well as like ultra marathon work. Folks like myself and other folks in the bodybuilding sector, which is pretty cool. And other people who work in endurance sport, Danny Lennon, probably familiar with that guy, all of us contributing to it. We had Alan Flanagan out there a couple of years back. Louise Burke has presented at SNA events. So it's a really cool conglomeration of individuals and really trying to make a clear, sustainable pathway for the sports nutrition profession. So anyway, I'm on the advisory board. Obviously, I'm biased, but I think it's a really important initiative. And Dr. Joe was there, Lauren Conlon, so a lot of the greats in the evidence-based space for bodybuilding practice. So it was really great just to see them all, and we had a good turnout, two-day event, both days sold out, and then I had a lot of fun doing the closest thing that I will ever do as someone afraid of heights to skydiving. I did indoor skydiving at the iFly place. Shout out to Matt White and his cousin-in-law, like his cousin's husband, Oliver Fong. He's an awesome instructor. So if you're out in Gold Coast and you want to be in a wind tunnel simulated skydiving, definitely recommend Oliver. He's a man.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad to hear that. I too am on the board of the SNA. However, I boycotted the event. So I don't believe in the Eastern Hemisphere, and I simply won't go. That's it. But I believe next year we're going to have an event in the United States on the correct hemisphere. And so there's a decent chance that I might be around for that one. So we'll see. I am, for those who are in the Kansas City, Missouri area, I am going to be speaking there in about a month at the Collegiate and Professional Sports Dietitians Association. They've got their national conference there. So if you're near Kansas City in about a month, check out that conference and come see me. It'll be cool. All right. So the Mass crew is speaking all over the globe, and that's good. One other thing I want to mention before we get into the good stuff here is, folks, our sale is still going strong. I believe our sale ends, is it May 3rd? Is that correct? We've got our bid. Let me check that. This is important. We got to get this right, Helms.
Yeah, we do. I think you check that. And I'll just say that, yeah, this is a big deal. We are turning 7. I can't believe that we've been doing the damn thing since 2017.
Yep.
We're going strong. We're growing strong. Also, huge shout out to Dr. Lauren Colenso-Semple, by far the biggest news. Forget that I turned 41. You know what? I'll skip it this year. I'm still 40. I'll take that hit.
Yeah.
And I'll just advance 2 years to 42 next year. But the most important thing is that Dr. Lauren Colenso-Semple, PhD, successfully defended her PhD in integrative physiology that she did at McMaster University, working alongside Stu Phillips. She's doing real science, folks. I needed my two hands to do my PhD on RPE, scale of 1 to 10. As long as I can count to 10, I was good to go. Now, she needs to do isotopic tracing of phenylalanine and muscle biopsies.
Microscopes, all that crap.
Microscopes, freezers, dogs and cats living together.
Yeah.
This crazy stuff.
I hear you. Well, I am happy for Lauren, not because of her accomplishments, not because it positively affects her life. I am happy because I make the little titles for Office Hours. And before we have an episode title, I just kind of say, like, Dr. Helms and Dr. Trexler, Dr. Zordos and Dr. Trexler. And I feel like a real jerk when she's the only person that I'm not throwing doctor. It looks like I'm, like, you know, taking some kind of jab at her every week. And I'm just relieved that now I can throw that doctor in there. It'll make things look better and more uniform formatting. So, and it's a big win for the Mass crew. We picked up another PhD. Not easy.
Tell you what. No. Do you ever watch the show The Big Bang Theory? I know the answer, but I'm going to go ahead and be polite and ask.
Yeah.
All right. Early on in The Big Bang Theory, there's the scene where all the main characters, they go into the dean's office. And one of the characters, Wolowitz, he is an engineer, not an astrophysicist like the rest.
Yeah.
So the dean goes, Dr. Kuthrapali. And he goes, Dr. back to the dean, and does that three times. And he finally gets to Wolowitz and goes, Mr. Wolowitz. And yeah. Now we don't have to do Miss Colenso-Semple anymore. We're all doctors. So now we can all be highbrow, ivory tower elitists who are out of touch. Yeah. And hopefully our content gets more respectable, but less useful to all of you, dear watchers and listeners.
That's the goal. So I did confirm our 7th anniversary sale. If you want to celebrate it with us by enjoying the lowest prices that we ever offer, that ends May 3rd. So you could pause this video as you're listening right now. Go to massresearchreview.com and subscribe. When you subscribe, even if you lock in at like a monthly rate that's a 30% discount right now, it's not like next month it'll go up to normal. If you subscribe and stay subscribed, that is the price of your subscription from now until the end of time.
Perpetuity.
Exactly, in perpetuity. So, all right, folks. Now, other ways that you could support us, of course, is by supporting this show. Like, rate, subscribe, review, tell a friend, send the links. Submit questions. You know the drill. But let's get into our little introductory segment here, which, Helms, we're going to talk a little bit about mini cuts. Okay, so we got a question in our portal, which is at massresearchreview.com/officehours with a hyphen in there. People can submit questions whenever they wish. We got one about mini cuts, and I wanted to begin, and it was like the ultimate fitness question. It was like, thoughts on mini cuts, right? That's what you always get there. So first I want to mention like what they are, right? So a mini cut, the general structure, and Helms, correct me if I'm wrong, because this is one of those things that is like purely colloquial, right? There's not like a robust academic literature on mini cuts. This is just a thing that's out there in the industry that people do. So that means you can't like look up the definitive ultimate definition for it. But my understanding, the way I've seen it done, the general structure with a mini cut is that it is a short cut. The shortest I've seen is like 2 weeks. Usually, I think people do something like 2 to 4 weeks in general, perhaps a little shorter, a little longer. But that's kind of what we're talking about. It's not like a 3 or 4 month, you know, robust cut. We're talking about basically you've been bulking for a while and you just quickly shift gears and you do a short like 2 to 4 week cut. Now, the fact that it's short makes you think, oh, so this is just like a, you know, easy little thing, kind of tighten things up. Not really the case in terms of the intensity of the cut, right? So usually when people do mini cuts, because it's so short, they actually do a fairly aggressive deficit. So they actually reduce their calories pretty considerably. And a lot of folks will say basically
go as aggressively as you can without, you know, inviting a really high risk of muscle loss. So people push their calories pretty low during this. Now, you might be wondering, why would someone do this mini cut? Why would they disrupt their bulking phase, slam on the brakes, jam it in reverse, and do this aggressive short cut? There's three typical justifications I see for this. Number one is pretty intuitive. Stay leaner during your long-term bulking phase, right? So when you zoom out and look at, you know, if I bulked over the course of a year, you know, I'm leaner because I threw four mini cuts in that year, kind of spread throughout the year, right? So that's the one, is just kind of staying leaner while still having this general upward trajectory with a bulking phase. Number two is to restore one's appetite. So this is something I can't relate to these days. I'm eating like crazy. But there are some folks who, when they try to bulk up, their appetite just totally shuts down. So some folks say, well, maybe I'll do a two-week deficit and see if maybe I can kind of restore a little bit of hunger, or at least just not feel really full all the time after that cut, that mini cut, I should say. And the third justification I often see, I think this is falling out of favor because it was kind of a hot topic, but that got a lot of criticism, a lot of that coming from me personally. I don't think I have such great influence that I killed it, but I think I whined about it enough that more influential people started kind of saying, yeah, actually, let's not do that. But the third justification is the idea that a mini cut will restore insulin sensitivity and basically make your mass gaining phase more efficient or more effective. Basically, that if you become...
gives you that mythical better P ratio.
Correct. Yeah, it all relates to that idea that if you do this cut, you know, if you are becoming a little bit insulin resistant, you know, you would restore some insulin sensitivity. You'd have a better P ratio. The next 5 pounds you gain, a higher percentage of that would be lean mass rather than fat mass. Not worth getting into all the details there, but the short version of that whole concept is that it's largely drawn from studies that involve overfeeding and underfeeding in people that are kind of on the extremes of the BMI spectrum. So some of the research is in folks with anorexia nervosa who are like overfeeding to, restore their body mass. Some of it is in, for example, people with very high BMIs, you know, 40, 45, 50 plus, who are undergoing like essentially experimental starvation studies to dramatically reduce their body mass very quickly. And so what they found was, hey, when you overfeed someone with anorexia nervosa who has lost a tremendous amount of fat-free mass, what do you know? They regain more fat-free mass than overfeeding someone with a BMI of 50, right? And that,
yeah, and importantly, including losses of organ tissue and bone.
Yeah,
not just like when we say fat-free mass, we mean that as a literal definition.
Mm-hmm. And then conversely, what happens when someone with a BMI of 14 loses some weight? Well, you know, it's probably lean mass because they probably already lost the vast majority of their fat mass en route to having a BMI of 14, right? Mm-hmm. And then conversely, you know, someone with a BMI of 55, you know, how much lean mass are they really going to lose when they start losing some weight and take off the first 5 pounds? I mean, it's probably almost all going to be fat. Not literally all, but mostly going to be fat. So This was used, all this research from kind of body composition extremes and folks who are not lifting weights, this was being used to try to apply that to folks who are lifting weights and in much more moderate BMI ranges. And the theory kind of falls flat when you poke and prod at it. But anyway, I think the first two are probably the two justifications that people are more inclined to kind of hold on to these days, which is that you stay leaner over a bulking phase, and perhaps you can kind of transiently revive your appetite after you've been, you know, way too full for way too long. So, Helms, I'm going to kick this to you first. My question for you is, the question is thoughts on, but I would say I'm interested to hear, first of all, if you utilize mini cuts, either yourself or with clients, and then I guess a secondary question would be, do you think that there are applications of these mini cuts, or would you advocate for a different route for someone who wanted to stay leaner during a bulking phase?
Yeah, no, I love the way you framed that, and I'll absolutely share my thoughts on both of those. The first thing I would say is that in most use cases, I'm skeptical of the idea of it being used to stimulate appetite, because most use cases includes most people who ideally, before they're going through cuts and bulks, have some nutritional habits in place that create a more favorable environment for nutritional changes, meaning they have a certain appropriate level of activity, they're already regularly exercising, they're eating plenty of fruits and vegetables, or reasonably high protein diet, they have consistency with their meal times, and ideally they are closer to something that resembles their quote-unquote natural levels of satiety and hunger, and not what would happen in the modern built environment in the Western world with hyperpalatable foods, processed foods, and very low activities, and a lot of, let's say, extrinsic environmental factors driving them to eat more than they otherwise would, right? In those situations, most of the time, we should be operating within our understanding of Speakman and colleagues' 2011 best fit model to explain body fat regulation of the dual intervention point model, where you have an upper intervention point and a lower intervention point. And when you get too high in body fat, and definitely when you get too low in body fat, which we're far better at defending, you start to see alterations in physiology, which impact hunger hormones and the experience of satiety and hunger. So if you were actually at a point, given all of that context, where you need to do a cut to be hungry again, you may be getting higher in body fat than is otherwise needed for your goal. That's not to say that you can't push yourself above your upper intervention point, but it is probably counterproductive in making it more challenging to do so. And theoretically, at least, you could operate within your two intervention points and still have a more normal satiety regulation. And I think this is a holdover from kind of the bodybuilding idea of you really got to eat big to get big. You know, if you competed at 160 a couple years ago, you need to push your body weight up in the off season, not to 180, but to 190 so you can compete at 170. And unfortunately, this doesn't work that way for natural bodybuilders outside of maybe their first couple years competing. And that is a bit of a carried over advice from people who have additional help to push to body weights that they otherwise would never be able to reach at a certain body composition, people on anabolic steroids. So I think for some people who do have really strong appetite and satiety regulation, naturally lean, skinny people trying to get bigger, that can be something that might need to occur. However, it is probably not it's not something I would say, hey, everyone needs to do this. And it's a good reason for everybody.
And if I could chime in, I think, you know, rather than going you, then me, maybe we can kind of have a free-flowing discussion. What a novel idea for two people in front of a microphone.
You don't want to just take turns lecturing?
Yeah, exactly. Dueling monologues. So you are an esteemed professional in the fitness space. I have done a little bit of stuff talking with folks who, for example, are you know, maybe collegiate or professional football players, and their ideal body type as a defensive tackle is, if I could get to 380 and still be fast, I'd be cool with that, right?
100%.
And so there are some cases outside of the kind of typical set of fitness enthusiast goals where we are going to be pushing that upper intervention point, and that's just going to be a reality of the goal. Right. So the classic example in the literature is obviously sumo wrestling, but we see, you know, high adiposity in certain sports where it's rewarded, you know, because you got to be a big body that's hard to move. And that's really advantageous. But even in those cases, Helms, I come in with the caveat that makes it look like I'm going to disagree, but now I throw the curveball. Okay. And I say, I still think even in those cases, I'm not sure that a mini cut would really help with appetite regulation in a kind of from a physiological perspective. Maybe a person might just feel kind of a transient psychological relief. Thank God I don't have to force feed for another 2 weeks, you know, almost a vacation, but not something that's going to induce a change in appetite regulation that they can carry forward out beyond that quote unquote vacation, right? Because all those factors impacting their appetite regulation are still there. During that little vacation mini cut to try to restore appetite, they're going to be, you know, in a deficit. And right after that's over, they're going to eat back up into where they started in terms of body weight. And I have to suspect that their appetite is going to be in an extremely similar spot. They just got to enjoy a little reprieve, which did come with the consequence of maybe taking a tiny, tiny, tiny step backward in terms of their weight gain. So even in the folks who really are trying to just get as big and heavy as possible, I think it might be nice from a psychological perspective to take that break. And I've heard many anecdotes from, I mean, you'll see some of these folks who, there's a great podcast interviewing them, but they're professional linemen in the NFL. And some of these folks naturally would be like 220, and they spend their whole professional career at 275. And they are constantly force feeding for like, from the age of like 16 to like 35, right? And yep. So I'm sure folks like that are going to take some time in the off season to say, okay, I'm just not going to force feed. I'm just going to give myself a break. But it is pretty wild. You'll see these folks and you don't really appreciate how much they're forcing themselves to eat until they retire. And within 1 year, they've lost 45 pounds. And you're like, whoa, what happened to you? You must be on the craziest training and dietary program imaginable. You really got serious. And they're like, no, I just went back to doing what feels right. You know, but of course, that's not everyone. There are a lot of folks who they're actually playing at their natural body weight and they struggle with their body weight pretty substantially after retirement. So it's a little bit of both. It kind of just depends on where you're at with your appetite. But anyway, all that is to say, I kind of agree with you that I'm skeptical of the appetite element, which would then bring us to the element of just staying leaner during a bulk. And I'll kick it back to you.
Absolutely. And for those who don't follow those other sports, there are parallels in super heavyweight powerlifters.
Sure.
I remember 1 year, you know, people think like travel is a pain in the ass when you have to make weight. It's actually a pain in the ass for super heavyweights as well. I remember 1 year Ray Williams was, I think Matt Gary or he was telling me about it. Or was it Kelly Branton? It doesn't matter. Many super heavyweights deal with the fact that if they have to fly to go compete in another country and they have long layovers, long flights, they can only pack so much. If you're flying from, you know, a country through Dubai to another place and traveling, I want to say one of those two super heavies at the time lost almost 10 pounds just in the traveling process.
Yeah.
Because of the amount of food, bulk, water, sodium, and then actual body fat loss that's occurring. Because when you weigh over 400 pounds and you're training and moving, you have a pretty ridiculously high energy expenditure because that's mostly lean body mass. And if you can't keep up with the 5,000-6,000 calorie diet that you need, and you don't really want to, you force yourself to,
yeah,
you can rapidly start losing weight within a matter of days. And then there's noticeable impacts on certain lifts. So
yeah.
Anywho, just as another data point for those who are a little more kind of insular in their sports content they consume, like myself, as far as just barbell related sports. So I do think mini cuts have utility, specifically for just controlling body fat for those who that is a notable goal. And the most obvious one to me is people who compete in physique sport, where ironically, and I've said this many times, that, you know, we look up to bodybuilders, competitive bodybuilders, the people who have it figured all out and are doing what's optimal for muscle gain. But I think actual competitive bodybuilders have one big flaw in our consideration of them being the people who carry the most muscle mass possible. It's probably even more than these other athletes. We forget that they diet themselves down to a state of muscle loss on a semi-regular basis. And that is something that is only necessary because they have to get shredded for the stage. And because they have to get shredded, that means they have to do things that are conducive to that, because that's when they're actually judged. So bulking, cutting, and cyclical phases of dieting that we see in the recreational bodybuilding community are far less necessary than the average person thinks and far less beneficial because they are necessary holdovers of being a competitive bodybuilder. If you have to diet down to a point where you're so lean that you're actually losing muscle, which is something that most recreational bodybuilders don't want to do except for maybe a one-time photo shoot, and I would generally recommend they not do. It's getting leaner than would be reasonably lean. They therefore have to restore fat mass, which means they therefore have to go through a bulking phase. They need to go through recovery. They're creating an environment where they have to recover, so therefore they have to diet so that they have to put weight back on. But I think the average recreational lifter could go through these kind of gain-taining phases and then mild cuts and just kind of maybe even spending some time recomping where they're staying within the kind of bottom third of their lower intervention point to upper intervention point range. They're kind of walk around leanish physique, if you will. And maybe they don't need to do these many cuts. But one very viable approach, which is totally fine, especially if you struggle with maintaining a small surplus, is having a more modest surplus and gaining weight for a period of time and shooting past the point where you're comfortable with your body fat level and then just doing a quick course correct and then repeating it. A decent rule of thumb, which is not at all evidence-based, it's just anecdotal-based, and I think it's a decent way to ensure that you're not spending too much of your career as a lifter constantly cutting, which I don't think is a healthy thing mentally, nor is it conducive to the goal of putting on muscle, is to have a minimum 4-to-1 ratio of time spent in a surplus or maintenance to time spent in a deficit. So on the more aggressive side of this, you could spend 4 months putting on mass, which might be, let's be honest, predominantly fat mass after the intermediate phase, but a decent chunk of muscle, to then get 1 month where you do a relatively aggressive cut and you're trying to essentially reduce all of the body fat you gained with having a negligible impact on the lean mass, and then rinsing and repeating. And again, that's kind of the minimum ratio I recommend. And I think that's a very viable strategy. And I can't confidently say it is better or worse, but I can definitely tell you that psychologically it can be better or worse for certain people than, say, taking an approach where you spend 8 months out of the year in a more modest surplus, and then you spend 2 months instead of one, or sorry, 3 months instead of two, or even four the rest of the year, actually just cutting in a more gradual manner, where and you're thinking, okay, well, what's the pros and cons? All right, well, you gain over 8 months, you're probably going to gain a similar amount, but maybe slightly less lean mass than if you'd done that at a faster pace. And likewise, you're at less risk of losing muscle mass dieting for, you know, a longer period at a lower, you know, at a smaller deficit, I should say. Six of one, half dozen of the other. And I think most of the time, you're just going to be working back from what is practically feasible given the constraints of your life. You know, so for a competitor, you think of, when's my next contest season? What's my likely stage weight? And my recommendation to everybody is target your last one. You might get pleasantly surprised if you're ready early, then you can eat up into your show. Don't predict that I gained X amount of weight that is lean mass in the off season. That's a fantastic way to not come in shape. Work back from there. Think how long it's going to take. Give yourself a buffer and then work in mini cuts at appropriate times in the off season to get to that as a starting point. So as an example, I'll use 2019 as a decent one. I spent all of 2017 and 2018 building up, or sorry, all of 2017 bulking up and the majority of 2018, but knowing that my stage weight is around 80 kilos or 175 pounds, I knew that the peak weight I got to of 98 kilos or roughly 216, that's too heavy for me to start to diet all the way down to 175 without it having to be protracted really long, risking additional muscle loss and being tedious. So I had a cut in April of 2018 to get from 98 to 94. And then I would just kind of put myself in a very small surplus. And then I had a cut from around 94, 95 down to around 89, 88 in October, September. So relatively aggressive. And then I let myself get back up to, by December, just under 90. And that's where I started my 2019 diet, which is right at the lower end of my intervention point, right around just under 200 pounds. Maybe it'll be a little higher this time around, is where I can walk around. So like right now, Trex, I was 89.3 this morning, slightly heavier weigh-in just because I went out to eat last night, a little more sodium than normal. And that's kind of where I feel I'm, if I miss a meal or if I go to bed and I was in a deficit for that day, I can just start to feel it. I can just start to disrupt my sleep. So I'm like skirting on the edge of my lower intervention point. And it's a pretty lean place to be, but I can push another 2, 3, 4 kilos up from there and then do a cut. And that's generally the way I operate, because the leaner I start my prep, so long as I'm not in a quote unquote dieted state, where I'm not beginning a prep already experiencing some aspects of low energy availability or being below my lower intervention point, it makes prep tremendously easier, gives me more wiggle room, more time, allows me to eat up, and I seem to look a lot better in the process and have less things to deal with. So that's one application, but I have absolutely gone through phases where I have done an extended bulking phase and then an extended cut. And I really don't think that one is necessarily better than the other, but I do think that some people will much prefer one versus the other. And the notable time where I think that is, it's not to do with the cut, it's more to do with the bulk. And that is if you really struggle with slow rates of weight gain, not in that you can't do it, like I just mess that up every time, but in that it's psychologically, it doesn't, you don't feel like you're making progress, and it is maybe too, what, it feels too much like you're spinning your wheels, not the inability to nutritionally manipulate things to do it. I think that's totally fine. The reason why it's not a good fit for someone, in my opinion, who gaintaining efforts turn into seafood diets and they gain too quickly, is that that's the actual problem. A mini cut is now a band-aid for that. If you were my athlete, if I was coaching you, and every time we tried to do a 200 kcal surplus, you ended up in an 800 calorie surplus and you were kind of just eating a lot, and you didn't feel like you had control over that, I would work to give you more agency and self-efficacy and control over your nutritional environment. And we would focus on that, not, whatever, well, we'll just do a mini cut. Because where do you go when you're done with that? When you're done working with me? Where do you go when you try to eat maintenance? You're going to run into the same problem. And I wouldn't want to just kind of kick that can down the road and leave future you with an issue without coaching advice sometime 5 years from now.
Yeah. Yeah, I think those are all great points. Really solid, thorough answer to the question. My little 2 cents that I'll throw in here. I'm open to mini cuts as a strategy. It's not my preferred route. And I think that's an offshoot of me really enjoying statistics and measurement. And what I find is when we're kind of oscillating back and forth between these like large surpluses and large deficits, back and forth over short time courses, it's like by the time body weight is actually stabilizing and we actually feel like we're really have a good idea of our true magnitude of our deficit or our surplus, we're switching again, right? And so like if you were to plot it out over time, there's just so much more noise in your data when you're looking at these like pretty large and pretty frequent fluctuations. I much prefer to go slow and steady, both with bulking phases and cutting phases. And my approach to a good bulking phase, I mean, Helms, you and I have talked about this many times in mass, but it looks like the surplus you need to facilitate muscle growth really is not as large as a lot of people believe. And so I'm of the belief that if you find that during your bulking every 4 to 6 weeks, you really need a mini cut, there's a good chance, if that's all I know about the situation, there's a good chance that you are very much overestimating how large of a surplus you really need during your bulking phases. So my general preference is to go with a more modest surplus and, you know, more uninterrupted, longer duration cutting and bulking phases. My idea, like you were saying, that ratio, I don't really have a number in my head, but my idea of a successful bodybuilding career is that cuts are the exception to what you're doing. You know, you spend the vast majority of your time trying to slowly build muscle over time. And it, you know, and that involves kind of these longer bulking phases. And then you cut basically when you have a pretty darn good reason to cut, you know, and that could be totally dependent on your goals, but there should be a reason why you're cutting that isn't just like, well, I guess I let that bulk get away from me, you know, because that tells me that the bulk probably wasn't planned as well as it ought to be. But yeah, so I mean, I'm not against mini cuts, like you said, depending on a person's goals or just their overall temperament and how they like to do things. Sometimes I will incorporate that type of strategy, but I think sometimes it makes things a little harder than it needs to be, and sometimes taking your time can really pay off. I tell you what, Helms, we've got hashtags. Okay. So are you ready for some of these?
I am, but I also have a selfish question as a tangent related to this topic, but let's do hashtags first.
Okay. Well, why don't you give me that question? Because we've got, we can get to the hashtags later. I don't want to get off topic too quickly if we're going to come back to it.
All right. So you and I are both big fans of Kevin Hall's research.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. One of the papers that I love that he wrote, I think over a decade now, is specifically on the energy content of different tissues and what is the required unit for weight loss. And there's some interesting calculations in there that also can be backed by modeling when you look at mixed weight loss and mixed weight gain and rates of weight gain and the associated surplus or deficit required. And an interesting thing is that a kilogram of adipose tissue, not pure fat, by the way, is, I think, just slightly under 8,000 calories. However, a kilogram of fat-free mass, if I recall correctly, is closer to like 1,800 calories or 1,400 calories. I might be mixing up glycogen or fat-free mass, but you can see what I'm getting at is it's somewhere between a quarter to a sixth of that kind of energy content.
Yeah.
And so one thing I've noticed as I've actually had a really, really successful gaining phase post-competition with me increasing my volume, training closer to failure, not training for powerlifting, and doing basically everything in my power to maximize this bodybuilding-specific bulking phase, and for the first time also trying to put on leg mass for 10 years or more, because I've always been bottom-heavy, is that I've seen a disproportionate weight gain compared to my estimated surplus. And that, to me, I wonder if you would agree that when successfully bulking and you are gaining predominantly lean mass, one should expect faster rate gain than would be anticipated by the nutritional approach they're taking. And this is something where I only have my recent experience, my coaching experiences, which I've seen when I'm working with certain athletes who are more novice and or doing things right for the first time. And also my best memory of when I was a newbie and thinking about what was I eating and how quickly did I gain weight over what time scale. And back then in like 2004, I didn't think about it in this way. I was like, I'm 170 and 6 months later, I'm 195. Like, that's a really fast pace of weight gain. And I think a lot of people experience that. And I don't know that they're necessarily eating in such a huge surplus as one would expect for someone to gain, say, 20 pounds of probably muscle in 6 months, because my body fat percentage visually did not change at all when we first started lifting. And that's not an uncommon thing for like skinny people who put on muscle mass. So anyway, what do you think about that? And do you think that that is a potential sign of a successful bulk for someone who has the potential to put on a lot of muscle in whatever circumstance they're in, that the weight gain seems to outpace the surplus and would be predicted for more mixed weight gain of predominantly fat tissue versus lean tissue?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that that's remotely controversial in terms of the kind of logical conclusion being reached there. Because, the most extreme application of that would be the case of someone recomp. All right, there we go. We're back on YouTube. Thanks for your patience, everybody. We are here doing our thing. So I was, I was answering your question, and basically the short version is, yeah, absolutely. I think you are on the objectively correct track there. I think that if you are experiencing like a really great bulking phase in terms of high lean mass gain and low fat mass gain, you would have gains in overall body weight that seem disproportionate and surprisingly high relative to your expected caloric surplus. So definitely on board with that. And with that answered, are we good to move on to some questions from the live chat?
Yeah, let's do it. And the only thing I would add is also I think there's the interaction effect of how much does your NEAT go up when you're in a surplus. I don't think mine goes up very much, by the way.
So. Yeah.
Yeah, that is another thing that can be a little bit trickier to kind of guess, right? I mean, because that's kind of what we're doing is, okay, you have to figure out, do I really think that my energy expenditure is ramping up, or do I think that there's been some lean mass gain occurring? And check your sleeves, see if they're tighter. That's basically how you figure that out. All right, so Helms, hashtags that we got to cover. We always do this in the chat. Trexie and I know it. That's a very good one. A lot of folks were commenting that they really like that one, that people saying hashtag of the year. So congrats to Ben Foster in the chat. Trextacular evening. Love that. That's every Wednesday night. Folks saying amazing Iron Culture episode this week. I'm rooting for you to bring hashtag Trexie back. That's a good one. Mm-hmm. Very, very creative there. There were some that were Tyrannosaurus Trex, of course. That's a classic. Eric Hexler and Eric Trelms. Those are a way to kind of shorten up the dynamic duo. We've got E squared equals MC Helms. And I do like the MC Helms portion, but I'm not sure if that math checks out if we're rearranging that equation. But either way,
it may not.
It works for our purposes. Trexalone acetate.
Ooh.
Interesting. Nightmare on Helm Street. I like that one. That one's pretty good.
Hey.
And then more Trex, more PEX. Who doesn't like more PEX? You could always use some more mass, right? Folks, love the hashtags. Appreciate it. We had someone mentioning that they were joining in from Greece. I think we also had someone mention that they were joining in from Singapore. Drop it in the chat where you're joining us from. It would appear that we have a global presence. We got Wisconsin in the mix as well. So yeah, let us know where you're viewing from, and we'll see how upset I get with the folks on the Eastern Hemisphere. Like I said, I don't go there. I protest it. It's just not my kind of thing. But
don't believe in it.
Yeah, it's not something I believe in. Okay, so a couple questions here, and I'm going to try to answer a couple ones relatively quickly here, just so that we can make sure we are doing our service to the good people who are in the chat. Got people chiming in from Sydney, Melbourne, Ireland. Ooh, were you out there in Australia just recruiting all week with these folks from Sydney and Melbourne?
I try. I do my best, you know.
Someone just mentioned that the live stream took a mini cut.
Yeah,
that's very creative. All right, so Helms, let's get to some quick questions here. And I might do the type of thing where I'll answer some, I'll kick some to you, and if I answer it and you disagree, then you can just get angry and chime in and let the people know what you believe the truth to be. First one from Ben here. Is there any reason to believe blood sugar spikes should be minimized for healthy individuals? I would say no. And I think that this question is probably alluding to something that's getting a little more trendy these days, which is using continuous glucose monitors and kind of micromanaging glycemic control and, you know, different peaks and valleys in blood glucose over time. You know, I would say if you are experiencing, if you're someone who does not have diabetes or prediabetes, and you are experiencing glucose excursions that do not cause any type of detectable symptoms, right? So if your blood glucose is getting so low that you're actually experiencing hypoglycemic symptoms, or that's kind of a different story, but these fluctuations that people are micromanaging with these continuous glucose monitors that are totally within the safe, healthy, normal range and not remotely symptomatic or clinically relevant, I just really wouldn't pay much attention to that. And perhaps folks will do the work to find ways to get something useful out of those continuous glucose monitors for healthy individuals. But for now, I'm simply just not seeing it. That is my personal take on it. Helms, here's one. Do you need a break between a bulk and a cut? Is there any science behind the idea of just kind of letting that new muscle kind of solidify or set?
Marinate.
Yeah.
So
This will be a fun answer because it's speculative and it'll make you, as the listener, aware of some kind of cool stuff that you may not otherwise be aware of, but ultimately the answer may not be as clear. There's some great work. There's a paper by Hahn and colleagues on sarcoplasmic hypertrophy that puts forth a number of different perspectives on it that differ from kind of our maybe 5, 10, and definitely 15 years ago perspective on sarcoplasmic hypertrophy being related to high rep, more metabolic work, or more like tension-based heavy work, and that's more myofibular. There's a lot of data indicating that sarcoplasmic growth always happens to some degree, always accompanies myofibular hypertrophy. No matter how you train, is going to happen, and it's a very small degree of hypertrophy, and that it's difficult to actually experimentally induce it when you start comparing different types of training, whether that's BFR, whether that's high rep, low load, and in a similar parallel, fiber type specific adaptations. However, there is one theory that Hahn and colleagues postulated that the sarcoplasm expands first to set the stage energetically and structurally for the myofibrillar hypertrophy that is to come. It is akin to, if I was to create an imperfect analogy, but still a useful one, when you see a new building getting set up and they put all the scaffolding up and they build some of the walls, but they haven't actually properly built the building. And I think that lends to some interesting speculation as to, okay, is that hypertrophy going to stick around? You know, if you don't continually provide that overload that should result in those adaptations to come. And, you know, maybe that's also why the data on muscle memory is inconsistent. So definitely check out some of the work done by there's some Nordic groups, as well as Alex Cogliari-Turner, the new doctor. He came back on Iron Culture not too long ago to kind of update everyone on the research he did. And essentially, when you look at the data on muscle memory, one pathway by which we think muscle memory occurs is the retention of myonuclei, the nuclei in the multinucleated muscle cells we have, that allow us to maintain more muscle mass because of the theoretical construct of myonuclear domain theory, that you need more nuclei to govern greater volumes of muscle mass. And when you lose muscle after having trained for a while, you go through a detraining period, you lose the muscle mass, but not the nuclei, so you can rapidly regain it because we have that ability to govern and energetically control more muscle mass. However, the nuclei are not always well maintained, and it seems specifically related to how long did you have the muscle mass for, how long did you train to get it, and in cases of anabolic steroid use, how long were you on high doses of androgens or not, because it doesn't always seem to be maintained, and we see different outcomes in some animal models, different outcomes in some observational studies on humans who have gone through detraining or periods of anabolic steroid use at high dosages, low dosages, or somewhere in between, and then periods where they have gone off it. So it is possible that there is something to be said for the idea that the most recent muscle mass you gained is the most potentially transient. So maybe if you did have a successful gaining phase, it wouldn't be a bad idea to not just go right into a cut afterwards. But I think that's also highly speculative. And I also don't think a cut is a death sentence for you must lose some muscle mass. In fact, I think a mini cut would have almost in all cases a negligible impact for the types of time frames we're talking about, even with a large deficit on muscle mass gained. And I guess the counter argument to that, to be my own kind of internal arguing person, is, well, I only gained a little bit of muscle anyway in my bulk. I'm an intermediate, I'm an advanced person, etc. But I would say that the anecdotes of people going through mini cuts and bulks and being able to still progress would indicate that's probably not at least a barrier progress. So I wouldn't worry about it. That's not something I think you must do, a solidifying phase, but it is an interesting question theoretically because of how we're unsure in a true mechanistic sense how muscle growth occurs at certain levels and how permanent they are. So yeah, anyway, fun answer, but ultimately I don't think it matters.
Yeah. All right. Someone mentioned we've got the best elevator music in the game. I think that's indisputable. I mean, I worked really hard picking out that music. People love it, and I'm glad to hear it. We got a question here. If I get sick while I'm on a cut, should I go back to maintenance? Does being sick make me more likely to lose muscle versus fat in a deficit? My answer it could be different from yours on this, Holmes, but mine is a bit biased based on some of the folks I've talked to lately who do work in developing nations. You know, we recently had this little conference on campus over there at Duke where we brought in people who study rural health. And when we talk about rural health in our context, we have a lot of folks who work with populations and communities that have kind of pre-industrial economies, right? So basically that means that they do hunting and foraging to acquire their food, or maybe they're like pastoralists, or they do some very, very, very small-scale farming. But these are communities where food resources sometimes are a little bit harder to come by. A lot of times the process of getting potable water is not super easy. There's a significant effort involved with that. And what we often find in these types of communities is that there is a pretty substantial exposure to various pathogens will elicit pretty frequent immune responses, right? There's just this kind of pathogen burden of various pathogens in the environment, whether it's from food exposure, water exposure, a variety of ailments that kind of spread throughout the community. And one of the things that's kind of interesting about an immune response is that it's pretty demanding from an energetic perspective. And one of the things we're interested in exploring is how different biomarkers of immune function differ based on the energy status of individuals. And there's good reason to believe that if you are chronically and, pretty severely underfed, it may be very, very difficult to mount an effective immune response when there is, some type of bacterial exposure or viral exposure that's causing illness and infection. So all of that is to say, I think it kind of depends on the degree of underfeeding and your kind of general energy status, so to speak. Like if you're in a really modest deficit and you're, 30% body fat, cutting your way down, probably not a huge deal. But if you're like pretty shredded and cutting pretty hard, I actually might consider going back into it, like back to maintenance, just to give yourself a chance to fight that off, give your body the resources it needs to mount an effective immune response. Because if you can get over that in a week, that's probably going to pay off in the long run, putting on the brakes, getting over it in a week instead of dragging it out for several weeks as your immune response really struggles to get along. Helms, any differing opinions with that?
I don't know. Totally agree.
Awesome. So here's a good one, Helms, for you. Should a good program include unilateral exercises like split squats and single leg RDLs to mitigate injury risk and muscle imbalances?
I think generally muscle imbalances are probably not something that we should be concerned with as a default setting. And we don't have good evidence to suggest that two muscles that are on either side of the body will contribute to the same muscle not producing a similar amount of force or not being the same size is actually related to injury. And by the time point it is very difficult to pick cause from effect. So there is some data observationally to suggest that maybe once you have like a 10% deficit in, say, antagonist or right-to-left force production, like a bilateral asymmetry, that can be associated with injury. But the problem is we're looking at cross-sectional data on people who are injured. And if you've had a prior hamstring strain or if you've had a prior ACL tear, the fact that the quadricep on that same side as that knee is producing 10% force in the other one, that may have not been the cause of the injury but a result of being injured. And the downtime from training and the potential reduction in neural drive, et cetera, all those things. So chicken or egg, real tough in injury-related research. It's not an unreasonable hypothesis. And, absence of evidence without evidence of absence and all those other good cliches. But I would say prospectively preventing muscle imbalances, I don't think should be the default setting for most programs. With that said, there is very viable reasons to do unilateral training in some cases, especially if you're someone who just doesn't have a lot of natural left-to-right asymmetry and you experience pain, discomfort, or feel more comfortable simply training in a unilateral manner. An easy way just to notice this is, even though like a dumbbell press is not a unilateral exercise, each arm is operating independently. And you may notice that the natural position that you do incline or flat or shoulder press, slightly different bar path, or I should say bell path on the left or right. You might also notice that your natural setup on a squat is that you have a slightly more externally rotated foot on the left or right. And so people try to correct that. And I would often just say, just go with it, you know?
Yeah, when I started trying to correct that, it caused way more problems than not a great plan.
Yeah, we are not perfectly symmetrical left or right. You should not assume that your shoulder joint or your hip joint is identical on the left or right side. And for those reasons, I would say if you have symptoms of issues training with bilateral movements, do unilateral. And then a complete aside is that sometimes unilateral exercises, for completely different reasons than the question asked, can be better. So for example, if you're trying to achieve a longer muscle length on your lat when doing a pull down, you can only do that so much with a bilateral exercise because the lats, based upon where they attach and where they anchor, reaching around a little bit and up and forward, like just right now, if you do this versus that, you're going to feel more stretch on your lat, as an example. So there are some exercises where you'll be able to get a better stimulus at the cost of it taking twice as long in the gym for certain exercises. So for bodybuilding purposes, perhaps, or definitely for sport-specific outcomes, where you're trying to get transfer from what you're doing in the gym to on-field, on-court, or any other type of performance that is unilateral in nature, like if you're a thrower or a pitcher or any type of gait pattern, then yeah, there's certainly arguments. But I wouldn't go, hey, if you're not doing unilateral exercises, you're at higher risk of injury, or if you're not doing unilateral exercises, you're more likely to have muscle imbalances. I don't think that is a well-supported position.
Yeah, I agree. I have a question here. How high do I need to go to get the theoretical benefits of higher reps? It kind of depends on what these theoretical benefits are. The old textbooks would say that that's where you get your muscular endurance, so to speak. High reps, usually you're talking about something in the, I would say, 20 to 30 range. Unless you're doing something that directly kind of mimics the type of task and duration that you're achieving with those sets, I think probably higher rep training as a specific targeted strategy is probably a bit overrated, right? For strength and power, we tend to do a lot of stuff in the lower rep ranges, and rightfully so. For hypertrophy, we have a lot of latitude doing a very broad range of repetitions from very low all the way to very high. Usually, I would say probably maxing out around 30 reps per set is where we typically see that. And that's not a hard stop, but that's generally where we see pretty good results with hypertrophy. If you're someone who's, I know a lot of folks who are endurance athletes, and they say, well, I want muscular endurance, so I'm going to do sets of 30. Well, doing sets of 30 has nothing to do with that marathon that you're running, because your marathon is a set of a zillion. I don't know how many steps are in a marathon, but you're talking about completely different ranges of what we would consider muscular endurance. So if you're an endurance athlete who's getting in the gym to do resistance training, my question is, for what, right? And so if you're trying to build some strength as an endurance athlete, then your strength training is still going to be reflective of pretty traditional strength training, right, in the rep range we associate with strength. Same thing if you're doing it for kind of bone and joint, durability and kind of trying to get some of those benefits from it, you're probably going heavy and doing some lower repetition training. So, I think that most folks who are trying to get some kind of unique benefit from high rep training are probably overestimating whatever those perceived benefits would be. Am I missing out any unique benefits of high rep training?
No, the only thing I would say is that when you take a very high level, liberal view and kind of like an ad hoc eyeball based meta-analysis of comparing training in a narrow rep range for hypertrophy versus comparing across a broader spectrum of rep ranges that not only includes higher rep ranges than, say, the 6 to 12 rep range, but also lower rep ranges, you generally see positive effects on a consistent basis leaning towards more variety in rep ranges and loads that are sometimes significant. Okay. And it almost seems independent of the model. There's the strength before hypertrophy periodized study that came out that actually was hypertrophy, strength, hypertrophy. There is a daily undulating study that came out of Schoenfeld's lab that compared 8 to 12 versus like 3 to 5, 8 to 12, and 20 to 30. There is a weekly undulating periodization study where whether they did weekly undulating or within the same session, both groups did quite well and not significantly different. There is another daily undulating one in women that came out, I think in 2014, that also had non-significant positive results. And you generally keep seeing this clustering where you probably don't want to constrain yourself to like just 6 to 12 or 8 to 12. And there is something, maybe complementary benefits, cyclical reductions in joint pain, or maybe ensuring that you're actually training to true failure more consistently because you're getting exposure to different points at which you reach failure and reaching failure for different reasons. That is the one downside that I would say is not represented in the literature, potentially a very high rep training, is that when you see a protocol when they're doing 20 to 30 rep sets to failure, they're being motivated by a whole group of lab, research assistants and researchers, and it's actually very difficult to push yourself to true muscular failure when you're doing 30 reps because your perception of RIR occurs earlier based upon that Halpern meta-analysis and also my anecdotal experience. You get, like, just do a little set of leg extensions for 20 reps to what feels like failure. I guarantee you can do two more reps in most cases unless you're a really experienced lifter, because the discomfort comes at a point before you can actually not overcome that external load, which simply doesn't happen if you were to do a set of five on squats.
Yeah. Good stuff. Okay. So, Helms, we got a question in here from someone who I believe to be a lawyer. It looks like they have Esquire at the end of their username. So, if I ever need pro bono legal services, that's legalese for free, I'm going to be reaching out to this individual. So, they have a very high maintenance intake level for their size. So, eating over 3,000 calories a day to maintain a body weight of less than 130 pounds. And they're worried about their saturated fat intake, you know, because a lot of times folks will say, hey, keep it to like, you know, no more than 10% of your calories for the day, something like that. Some people say 7, some people say 10. I think 10 is probably the more common. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, I would agree.
So the question is, you know, should I have a different number that I'm aiming for since my calorie intake is so high? It kind of drives up that, you know, 10% number of my total calories. And I would say, you know, if you're worried about that, sometimes I do think about the major pitfalls of these percentage-based recommendations when you're dealing with folks, especially in the bodybuilding world, where someone could be eating 4,500 calories a day or like 1,400. That could be the same person sometimes, right? And so these percentages get a little bit wacky. So what I usually tell people is, listen, these percentages are derived from research that most of the folks in there are eating somewhere between 2,000 and 2,500 calories per day. So if you really want to just kind of simplify some of these things and get just like a set number to shoot for as like a minimum or a maximum, depending on, you know, what you're looking at there. Like for saturated fat, say, okay, what would be 10% of my calories if I was eating 2,000 or maybe 2,500 calories per day? I would just set it there. And then if you're kind of bulking up and getting extra calories from elsewhere, you're getting it from starches, you're getting it from, you know, other types of fat in the diet. And, you know, that's kind of the way I would approach it, is just what would it be if I were eating a more typical caloric intake? And there's another question here that's kind of in a similar vein. It's about daily intake for fiber, asking if I had any recommendations. And Chris was saying, I'm not sure if I have stomach issues when I have 30 plus grams of fiber or if it's just the type of fiber or carbs that I'm eating. So with fiber, the kind of generic recommendation is 14 grams of fiber per 1,000 calories in the diet. But again, I don't really love that, because when I've got a bodybuilder who's, you know, on 1,500 calories,
I'd prefer that they're getting plenty of fiber, and they're probably going to prefer it as well, because otherwise they're going to have issues with potentially constipation, being quite hungry. So, yeah.
If I share my screen, will it break everything?
I don't know. We can try it. What do you got?
Let's try. I actually recently, our RD Steve Taylor for 3DMJ put together fruit, vegetable, and fiber intake recommendations. I was like, mm-hmm. Yeah, I've actually got it. I've got an image for that.
Yeah. So, go ahead and throw it up there.
We'll see. Try?
Yeah, yeah. I won't be able to see it, but you can talk through it.
Okay. So here we go. We're going to see what happens here, folks. And I'm going to try watching on the live stream to see what happens. Hopefully this will actually work as planned.
Okay. No, work. I actually can see it. Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. And if I take you guys through this, so Steve Taylor is, he's the 3DMJ dietitian, and he created some recommendations built off of what are the actual best recommendations, but that work together with fruit and vegetable intake, which are great for health. They're great for getting in nitrates, like Dr. Trex has talked about multiple times, and also for appetite management. And here we can see them based upon energy intake ranges as well, which can be utilized when you're cutting or bulking or for different sizes of people. And I find these are really helpful because, just like Trex was talking about, you can see they don't perfectly scale with energy intake. We've got 20 grams, and I like this, on at least 5 days per week. So it kind of allows you to have some of those days that just don't fit nicely with kind of the fruit and vegetable recommendations we have, which I think is pretty cool. So anyway, you can see they kind of scale up. And then there is a point where we're like, listen, we don't need to really go any higher than, say, like 38, 40 grams, because it does start to become like too much in many cases. I don't think there's an upper limit to the recommendations for fiber. And this is only something that you can get from working with bodybuilders and people eating healthy diets and high calorie intakes. But yeah, I think this is a pretty useful perspective. So yeah, generally it kind of starts at 20, ends around 40, and starts around 1500 calories, ends around 3000 calories is kind of your heuristic here, if you want to kind of think of it that way. Yeah. So anyway, I don't know. What do you think about these tricks?
Yeah, they line up pretty well with what I often do. Although I like to give people a little bit more flexibility in the, I mean, obviously this table is not like a hard and fast kind of rule, but I usually like to do with folks is say, hey, my clients tend to do best when they are eating somewhere between 20 and 50 grams of fiber a day. And I have had some folks who eat, really, really high fiber intakes and do well with it. So what I usually say is, like, you know, most people like to be between 20 and 40. Some like to go even higher into that 50 range. And so let's start kind of in the middle of that range. Let's adjust and kind of try some new things and see where you find a comfortable middle ground. Because if you're going too low with the fiber, like I said, you could run into constipation issues. You could run into having a bunch of hunger. If you go too high with the fiber, especially if you're trying to bulk up, you might run into issues on the other end of the spectrum where it's just hard to get your calories in because there's too much satiety, too much fullness. And then, of course, if you go really high with it, a lot of people just feel bloated and gassy and things like that. So I try to work through finding a middle ground. But the other part of the question there about having, you know, not being sure if it's too much fiber or the type of carbs and fiber, I think that's definitely worth exploring. Now, I'm not the type of person who's typically telling you to worry about all these kind of loosely defined, poorly defined details of dietary food selection. I usually try to keep things simple. But this is an area where there is a lot of variability in terms of how a person might react to different types of carbohydrate sources when it comes to stomach symptoms, right? Gastrointestinal symptoms. So it could be very well that, for example, there are certain types of fiber that make you feel kind of bloated and some that don't, right? You might find that, you know, maybe you do better with insoluble fiber compared to soluble fiber, or that you need to kind of titrate how much you have of one versus the other. Another thing is that fibrous and a lot of foods that have a meaningful amount of fiber, many of them do fall within the category of what we call FODMAPs, And so there are a number of carbohydrate sources that people may just be kind of sensitive to. And there's also just weird stuff. Like I've noticed that apples don't really sit well with me, right? Like I know a lot of folks who have like a random like fruit or vegetable that they're like, I don't need to know exactly why this is, but I've tried it 100 times and I've gotten the same result 100 times and I'm just not going to do that anymore, right? So the thing that's really tricky with gastrointestinal symptoms is that, yeah, especially a lot of carbohydrate foods can be a little bit hard to predict from person to person, but really consistent within person in terms of causing some issues. And another thing to look out for, if you're noticing that you're having some GI issues and you think it might be related to some of your carby-ish kind of foods, if you're eating a lot of prepackaged foods, check out the sugar alcohols that are in your foods. I'm not like scaremongering that they're, you know, these things are lurking in your foods, trying to kill you. But sugar alcohols, some of them digest quite well. Some of them are literally laxatives. Like at a high dose, they just are like clockwork. And then many of them are in between.
Erythritol, it makes for a bad sensory experience for those around me. I'll just say that if I have even a small amount.
Really? Erythritol?
Yeah.
Wow.
If I use that. So there was a period where I was consuming a supplement brand line that used that as their primary supplement.
Yeah.
And you would have thought that either I was consuming carrion or that I had late stage bowel cancer for the types of smells that were coming out of me. And I'm like, I can't do this. Like, this is bad. You know, when your own gases bother you, like that's a bad fart. We were dealing with that like frequently, multiple times per day.
I would also warn people. So when I heard about like sugar-free or low sugar chocolate, I was like, oh my god, you're kidding me. And I think the preferred sugar alcohol, I believe, is maltitol for low sugar or sugar-free chocolate. And I think for chocolate, it gives a much better texture than alternatives, but it's just like a laxative. It just really is, folks. You got to be really careful with that. And then, of course, the internet, the classic story is someone ate like a whole bag of the gummy bears that had
sugar-free. The Olestra sprinkles. Those aren't sugar alcohols. But the undigestible fat. But yeah, lots of those fun stories on the internet.
Yeah, there's like a classic product review for the sugar-free Haribo gummy bears that apparently is just extremely detailed, and it's written as like almost like a short novella. It's like really someone put a lot of time and effort into it. But all of that is to say, like, if you think you're crazy because certain carbohydrate foods aren't sitting well with you, it's actually worth doing some experimentation because there are some resistant starches and certain forms of fiber and certain sugar alcohols and you know, even like I said, certain FODMAPs that may just like, you know, very legitimately not sit well with you, and you might want to just alter your food choices accordingly. So very astute observation, the idea of saying, well, maybe it's having too much fiber, but maybe there's a more qualitative element that needs to be addressed rather than just the total number there. All right. Someone said here, Trex and Helms are my religion. I accept that because I do work in the Religion and Social Change Laboratory at my university. So that makes sense. I think that's a completely understandable thing. There was a really good question here that I had for you, Helms. Oh, yeah, it was the very first question, actually, before we were all shuffling in. As I approach the end of a cut, how can I distinguish between symptoms of diet fatigue and pushing past my lower intervention point? Am I too lean, or am I having diet fatigue? And I guess a question that I have personally, what's diet fatigue?
Yeah, that's a great question.
I'm not trying to be a smartass or make a point. I don't know what it means.
I think it is the collective experience people get when dieting to be reasonably lean, or maybe even not reasonably lean, losing a fair amount of weight. It's fatigue that we associate with dieting.
Okay,
right?
I could have put that together.
And It's a little bit built into the name. But I think I would actually refer this person to, I believe, Trex, correct me if I'm wrong, either one or two times ago when you and I jumped on one of these, or was it Iron Culture? Okay. Either Iron Culture.
We need to stop doing so many things together.
I know. Or one of our mass office hours, or a mass office hours where we talked about this and referred to the Iron Culture episode, where we talked about the overlap between REDS, low energy availability, exercise energy compensation, and metabolic adaptation, and how challenging it is to tell which is which, because they often overlap, specifically for people who are dieting to get really lean.
That was an Iron Culture episode.
Yeah. Okay.
It's called a unified theory of metabolic adaptation or something like that.
So what I'd recommend is check out Iron Culture, and I want you to watch a unified theory of metabolic adaptation, me and Trex talking about how all these things do overlap and how specifically in people who are dieting and get reasonably lean and doing cardio to do it, you're probably experiencing two plus of these, and also overtraining gets thrown in there. And it is actually very difficult to tell. And until you solve one problem without accidentally overshooting on another, which is very common, you diet yourself so hard, you get so lean, or you lose so much body fat, then you temporarily get below your set point and then overeat to get above it. And then you can't tell, you know, where should have you theoretically been able to stop. It's pretty challenging. So, I would refer people to that episode, or this will be a very, very long answer that'll take us well past the next maybe, you know, 10 minutes before we shut down office hours.
Clarification, apparently it was both. So apparently we talked about it in that Iron Culture episode, and we've also chatted about it here as well. People of our advanced age, Helms, we forget that we talked about it already. You know, we talk about it again. We'll probably cover it in an episode near you any time in the near future. And Helms, now that you're 41, even when we kind of catch you doing this, we just kind of let you go. We've been told to not startle you or bring it to your attention, and just kind of let you tell the story again, if that's okay.
Yeah, you can't. Don't show me the existential threat of my own fading consciousness, or it's not going to go well for anybody.
Yeah. Okay, so we got a question here. Can smaller muscles be trained every single day? And we're talking like 10 plus sets a day. What do you think?
I don't think muscles actually respond substantially differently. I think most of those observations are from two other things that are related. There's less systemic fatigue for the exercises we use to train small muscle groups. So calf raises are just not that hard. Neither are bicep curls, neither are tricep pushdowns, neither are lateral raises. Or, in many cases, the exercises themselves are such that the biomechanics doesn't cause much muscle damage, like a dumbbell lateral raise, where they're hard at a shortened position. And if you actually were to do, say, a cable lateral raise where you started in the position where your shoulder is most stretched, and you do that for the first time ever after only doing dumbbell lateral raises for the first time in your life, you might experience actual DOMS in your medial delt, and you would not be able to train it as frequently. So I would say, though, however, that exercises that train less muscle and induce less stress are not actually loading. And when you take them, you know, not as close to failure, even when you do take them close to failure, if they're a single joint movement, they're just easier to recover from. But it may not have to do with the specific muscles trained, but the amount of muscle trained and the arc of recovery and the exercise used as to whether it's harder at longer muscle lengths or not.
Yeah. All right, man. We got a question here, and I really want to address this one because it's a common misconception, okay? So we had a question, can energy compensation really be beaten by high energy expenditure sports, i.e. endurance sports like cross country or even explosive sports like MMA, wrestling, boxing, etc.? So energy compensation, the idea of it being beaten, I think kind of what they're referring to here is there is work out of our lab at Duke, the one I work in, the leader of that lab is Herman Ponser, who wrote the book Burn. There appears to be kind of a metabolic ceiling. I wouldn't call it a hard ceiling, more of a soft ceiling, but
it's a tent.
It seems like a limit that if it is exceeded, it's not often and not by a lot. Okay, so a general cap there on total daily energy expenditure, and it seems to be about 2.5 times a person's basal metabolic rate. And a lot of folks will say, well, wait a minute. I bet if I just went nuts and trained my butt off today, I could easily burn 6 times my basal metabolic rate if I really, really wanted to. And so a lot of folks say, well, you folks over there at Duke are full of crap and you're actually quite dumb. Well, we thought about that, folks. And so it all comes down to a misconception. So the idea with that metabolic ceiling is that it pertains to the highest energy expenditure that a person can maintain long term as like a regular everyday expenditure. Now, in the short term, you can burn as many calories as you wish over the span of a day or 2 days. But what we find is a really steep drop off, this kind of nonlinear effect where people kind of asymptotically, these really, really active folks, start to approach this limit of 2.5 times their basal metabolic rate. So if you're trying to do, there's a really great figure of this in a paper that I think was by Thurber and colleagues. But basically the idea is, you know, oh, for a day or two, for a week or two, you can well exceed 2.5 times basal metabolic rate. But as duration increases on the x-axis, it drops off really, really quickly. And what we find is that over the span of, months and months and months, very unlikely that you're regularly going to be maintaining an energy expenditure that exceeds 2.5 times basal metabolic rate. Now, what's really interesting, Helms, is that women that are pregnant often achieve an energy expenditure because of the energy cost of pregnancy that is actually like pretty close to 2.5. It ends up being in that like 2.2 to 2.4, sometimes 2.5 range. Now, we cooked up a crazy idea because like I can't say enough positive things about Herman. He is an excellent scientist. And when he does it the right way in the sense that he is trying to prove himself wrong rather than prove himself right. So he said, okay, if there are folks out there who are routinely maintaining energy expenditures above this, what about like a pregnant marathon runner, right?
I love it.
And so we actually, there's a very, very sharp PhD student in our lab who has already collected a substantial amount of data from endurance athletes who happen to be pregnant and are maintaining a high level of training all the way through like third trimester. So we are like literally going out and trying to find the people who are most likely to be kind of breaking through this ceiling. And I'm not allowed to share that data yet, but it's really, really fascinating work.
Are you also collecting data on breastfeeding athletes as well? Because they maintain a pretty high energy expenditure during that phase as well.
I believe that is like the next phase is that we are, there are some folks that are kind of continuing on into that lactation phase as well. Yeah, so we're doing some really cool, and we're getting great, you know, doubly labeled water, total daily energy expenditure data. So it's going to be really cool. And I'm excited for the world to be able to see that data because I think a lot of people are going to be really surprised by what we find, but that's all I can say about it. So all of that is to say,
take home is there's a difference between being a hunter gatherer and running a marathon once.
Yes, exactly. As you try to say, well, maybe I'll run a marathon every day for the rest of my life. It probably not going to work out, and you'll probably find that because you are trying to exceed a sustainable total daily energy expenditure, probably some not so great stuff is going to happen, right? So I think what's really interesting is that there are both the kind of physiological limits, maybe, that seem to constrain energy expenditure. One of the big challenges there is that it doesn't seem like people are routinely able to actually consistently consume more than 2.5 times their BMR in caloric intake. It's hard to say if that's due to appetite regulation factors or like literally just your gut's ability to extract that many calories from the diet in a day. But what that means is that even if you are for a time maintaining a really high activity level and exceeding that energy expenditure level in the short term, the higher you are above that, the greater energy deficit that you're in. And so now you're saying, well, I'm not just going to be super active and not give myself the ability to recover, but I'm actually also going to be in a massive caloric deficit daily as I'm doing that. And so I think one of the practical constraints, physiology aside, is that your body's going to break down. Like you're doing this crazy high impact exercise, insane volumes daily. So I think aside from the physiological kind of evolutionary view of limits, there's also just the practical of how long can you actually keep that up and be in a, you know, what? I mean, like a 2,500 calorie per day deficit? Like, good luck with that. It's going to be awful. Yeah. So yeah, it's fascinating stuff.
Totally agree. And I think that's really interesting. And I can't wait to see some of that data, man. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. There's some really cool stuff going on that. Also, I saw someone had a question in here, and I'm just going to tease another project, which is just not satisfying podcast whatsoever, because it's just like, hey, there will be a cool thing, but you can't see it. So we talked a little bit about, we talked a decent amount, actually, about, dual intervention point theory by John Speakman. We did have a question. What's your opinion on research surrounding why athletes can achieve high performance whilst in an energy deficit? A lot of it published by Jose Areta. So someone asked.
So real quick on that.
Yeah.
The data by Areta is actually at low energy availability, not necessarily in an energy deficit.
Yeah.
And sometimes people are in a state of low energy availability, but not at a deficit.
Yeah.
And I would refer people to the 2023 updated statement on low energy availability in REDS. And they introduced a really important concept of functional or non-functional low energy availability, which is acknowledging that it's actually a pretty normal human thing to be in states, well, maybe for thousands of years of the human race's development of low energy availability, but still able to function sufficiently. And that we should view the response a low energy availability on this kind of facilitative or debilitative spectrum.
Yeah.
And that you can absolutely, for periods of time, not really be getting too many negative consequences from that, even though your body would prefer, if that's such a thing, to have more calories to run more systems optimally. I'll just put that there.
Yeah. So what I'm going to tease to kind of end the episode here is I am indeed working on a project, and if all goes well, we're going to have the good Dr. John Speakman involved. We're going to have Jose Areta or Areta involved. It is going to be just an all-star cast of folks who have been agonizing over these questions of energy availability and energy expenditure in active people and trying to figure out how we keep this whole human body regulated to the best of our ability. So I'm really excited to kind of dig into some of these questions that people are bringing up. And I personally view that as a huge vindication, Helms, that our audience asks great questions and they know who to name drop in their questions, because those are the folks who, when I am really confused by stuff, I say, hey, folks, let's collaborate on something and try to figure this out, right? So I think that's a good cue to once again thank the audience for a very fruitful discussion. Really great questions tonight in the live chat. Thanks so much to everyone who joins us in the live chat. That is what makes this show what it is. Very, very special to have everyone here live and to be able to interact with you in real time. We are wrapping up yet another episode, I believe episode 33 of Mass Office Hours. Thanks for joining us in the live chat. Thanks to everyone who will be listening to this at a later date, whether you like catching the replay on YouTube or catching it on your favorite podcast platform. If you want to submit a question, check the link in the description of this episode. It's massresearchreview.com/officehours with a hyphen between office and hours. You can submit questions anytime you wish. And one last reminder, folks, take advantage of the Mass Anniversary Sale. 7th anniversary only comes around once. Prices are about 30% discounted on all of our subscriptions, monthly, yearly, and lifetime. We think it's a really great offer. Helms, we're working hard every month to give people the absolute cutting edge when it comes to exercise and fitness and nutrition-related research. It's you, it's me, it's Dr. Zordos. It is Dr. Colenso Semple. And everyone, make sure you go find Lauren on Instagram and congratulate her on a job well done defending her dissertation. It's a happy time in Mass World, celebrating a new PhD and a 7th anniversary. So everyone, thanks so much. Hope you have a fantastic evening. Take care of yourselves, and I will see you in 1 week with another episode of Mass Office Hours.